Tax update for Saturday, September the 23rd, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, September the 23rd, 2006. This week, not quite horseshoes, close isn't good enough for charitable appraisals. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to determine race in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged without prior permission. This podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services on the web at www.limebergservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.limebergservices.com. Well, this week I'm recording the podcast while getting ready for my trip coming up to the South, going through first Roanoke, Virginia on this weekend. I'll be leaving for Roanoke on the Friday, which probably will be the same day you receive this podcast if you're subscribed via iTunes. And I'll be speaking on Monday at the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Conference on various technology update matters, primarily dealing with security, Vista, and other wondrous things that are impacting technology in the accounting profession. And then on Wednesday, I'll be speaking in Memphis, Tennessee, doing a full-day presentation for the Tennessee Society of CPAs on employee benefit plans. So I'm recording this podcast in preparation for leaving town for a while, and hopefully we'll get back and get another one done in time to do the next podcast. At least after this week, I'm staying in town through the October 15th filing deadline, so we're pretty much done with my travels until after October 15th. After that date, I'll be doing a series of presentations in Ohio, but that comes up beginning the 24th of October and going through the 24th, 25th, and 26th in three cities in Ohio. This week, though, we're going to take a look at charitable contributions, which have attracted a lot of attention recently. As you're probably aware, Congress made a number of changes in the recent tax law to what we have to do to document charitable contributions, whether they be cash or non-cash. As well, there were a number of interesting cases that were highlighted in Steve Lineberg's Charitable Planning Newsletter number 104. That was a series of cases. The cases were Harrell, Warren, and the Warfield cases, all of which involved very, shall we say, undocumented charitable contributions reported on the returns of those three individuals. All three individuals had used the same tax preparer, probably not a coincidence there. It's not a coincidence that the returns looked very similar and not a coincidence that the IRS appeared to be picking this group to go after. But this we were going to look at another case that was not a case where there's any question the charitable contribution was made. But in this case, the problem is the taxpayer neglected to dot his I's and cross his T's on the issue of the charitable appraisal that's required for non-cash contributions of items other than marketable securities in excess of $5,000. As you should be aware, contributions, non-cash contributions of that sort, are required to have appraisals and required to have the charity sign off on the 8283 that goes with the return, as well as the appraiser sign off on the 8283 that goes with the return regarding the contribution. In this case, we had a taxpayer who didn't do it. Now, a number of years ago, you may be aware, there was a case that got a lot of notoriety in the tax practitioner community because it involved John Hewitt of Jackson Hewitt fame, who gave Jackson Hewitt stock, at the time not publicly traded stock, and ran into the buzzsaw of the tax court and the Court of Appeals that ruled that failing to get the appraisal, even though the value of the stock may have been totally proper, and in his case it certainly appeared to be totally proper, was still sufficient to lose the deduction given the way the code and regulations read. In this case, we're going to consider the case this week of Nay versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary 2006-154, where again we have a case where it appears the taxpayer has very good documentation for having made a deduction, made a contribution, and in fact has a pretty good idea of what the contribution is worth, but still nevertheless loses on failing to dot the I's and cross the T's. And the lesson in this case is going to be the importance of following through and doing things as they are required under the law when you have charitable contributions, large non-cash ones. Now, the taxpayers in this case owned a couple of parcels of farmland in Delaware. And the taxpayers contacted the Delaware Agricultural Lands Preservation Foundation. In the case, it'll be referred to by DALFP, constantly the initials, because I guess the tax court really didn't want to write that long term out every time they referred to this. And the issue became about selling their development rights to their two parcels of farmland to the foundation. The court reported that this foundation exists primarily to help ensure that farmland in Delaware remains farmland and is not developed and used for other purposes. And what this foundation does is purchases and obtains development rights on farmland, still allows the owner of the land to hold title to the land. The hitch has become the owner has now agreed not to use it for anything except the farming agricultural purposes and not to develop the land and allow it to go to some other use. Now, in doing this, of course, the question of what are those rights worth comes up, and the foundation had appraisals of the rights for each property prepared by an appraiser they hired in November of 1999. In April of 2000, apparently as part of the negotiation process, the Nays, who are the taxpayers in this case, had another appraisal of one of the property's development rights prepared by a second company. The Nays appraisal specifically stated it was prepared solely for use in determining development rights in accordance with the DALPF, and neither appraisal indicated they would be used for income tax purposes. Now, this is not terribly unusual. Appraisals tend to be restricted in use. The reason the appraiser wants to be compensated for the level of risk he or she is taking on. Obviously, appraisals usually are being asked for some reason, and the exposure is different depending upon the reason that the appraiser is having to put forth on a value. Now, the Nays went ahead and sold the development rights in both parcels for an amount less than the appraised values of the rights to the foundation in 2001. And on their 2001, they claimed a non-cash charitable contribution for this bargain sale element of $210,306 on Form 8283. Now, the Form 8283 they submitted only filled in the very basic part about a non-cash contribution. It was not signed by a representative of the foundation in the Donee Acknowledgement section. As well, the form was also not signed by any of the appraisers in the section that deals with the declaration of the appraiser. So the 8283 merely reported that there was a donation of these development rights, claimed a deduction of $210,000, but left blank the two sections dealing with the donee's acknowledgement they had received this gift and the appraiser's certification to an appraisal that had been prepared. Not surprisingly, given the size of the contribution and what's an obvious problem in the 8283, the IRS examined the Nays 2001 return. And as we all kind of expect, the non-cash contribution became a key issue. Now, in May of 2004, because this date becomes important, the IRS sent the Nays an information document request that specifically requested they submit a new Form 8283 signed by an appraiser and the donee, as well as complete appraisals for both parcels of land. Now, these are appraisals they're supposed to already have in their possession, and the IRS was asking them to go ahead and get the signatures and then submit the appraisals which apparently they should have. Now, no doubt from the Nays' standpoint, they believed, well, we've got appraisals because there were three separate appraisals done on two properties that took place during our negotiations phase. So, hey, we have appraisals, so all we got to do is get the appraisers to sign off and get the Donee organization to sign off. Well, the organization, the foundation, signed off. That wasn't a problem. But neither appraiser, the one the foundation had hired, nor the one that the Nays had hired, would initially sign off on the appraisal summary and make their statement that they were the appraiser for income tax purposes, nor did they submit their appraisal as a qualified appraisal of the property in question. In lieu of the appraisals, the Nays ended up submitting a letter from an attorney for the foundation indicating that the Foundation's appraisers were not willing to sign the 8283. They sent that in along with the 8283 that was signed by a representative of the Foundation. That document was submitted in July of 2004, or about 2 months after the IRS had initially requested that the document be sent. The IRS, suffice it to say, was not impressed. In June of 2005, the IRS went ahead and disallowed the deduction in full, determining a deficiency of about $46,000 in their 2001 income taxes, at which point the Nays filed their tax court petition. Now, the $46,000 deficiency was not solely related to this. There was some question as to whether there was a gain involved on the sale that took place, since it was a bargain sale element. And that issue is one that actually was not decided in this case. This case involved the motions for summary judgment. So apparently they will go forward and go to trial on the issue of whether or not there is a gain. But the IRS did make a motion for summary judgment on the charitable contribution. In November of 2005, now this of course was after the IRS had issued their notice of deficiency and after the tax court petition had been filed, the Nays finally obtained an additional appraiser document from the company that they had hired to do their appraisal when they were negotiating with DALPF. And in February of that year, the Nays provided the IRS with that appraisal, apparently a fully good qualified appraisal, that we would have been qualified if done at the date that the gift had taken place or within that time period, along with an 8283 signed by the president of the company that handled the appraisal. So now the Nays had obtained the document in question. They had an appraisal, and the only hitch was, of course, that this appraisal on a 2001 contribution was not actually provided to the IRS until February of 2006, well after the return had been filed, and of course, clearly was not prepared until well after the contribution had taken place. However, the Nays were arguing, and they did represent themselves in this case, that this looked to them like a no harm, no foul situation. The IRS finally was given an appraisal to substantiate the deduction. The appraiser signed off on the 8283, along with agreeing to all the statements on the form. The contribution clearly had been made. The donor organization acknowledged that. So they should be able to get it because clearly a charitable contribution had been made, and maybe our only question might be whether the appraisal was too high or, you know, that they were claiming more than they should. But clearly a contribution had taken place, and clearly something of significant value had been contributed. But the IRS didn't see it that way. And they stood by their position that the entire deduction was disallowed due to the fact solely that taxpayers did not comply with the specific requirements of the regulation to document and to obtain the appraisal in a timely fashion. The taxpayers learned an expensive lesson here because the tax court agreed with the IRS. The court pointed out that, as was held in that 1997 Hewitt case, strict compliance with these regulations is generally required. The court points out that these regulations really deal not with whether a contribution was made, that's not the question, or even its amount of contribution, but rather with strict documentation rules that are to be applied for the deduction to be allowed, and taxpayers who don't follow the rules will lose out. Congress had passed these provisions to help enable the IRS to enforce provisions and make sure that taxpayers were not taking excessive deductions on their tax return, so the IRS would be able to assure that a real appraisal with an appraiser the IRS could hold accountable had taken place at the time the contribution was made. Now, the Nays agreed they didn't strictly follow the regulations, but they argued they should still be allowed a deduction. They argued for what is a normal defense in this case, if you're going to have a defense, substantial compliance. The Nays relied heavily on the 1993 case of Bond, which is 100 TC32. Now, the court notes that in the Bond case where the deduction was allowed, the taxpayers had a property that was appraised by a qualified appraiser within the specified time period. However, the appraiser did not prepare a separate appraisal document, nor did he list his qualifications on the Form 8283. Shortly after the exam got underway, the appraiser submitted the letter outlining his qualifications to the IRS. In Bond, the court held the taxpayers had provided substantially all of the information required by the regulation and that with the letter that was submitted early on in the process, that the taxpayers had basically done enough to comply and should not lose their deduction. It would be unfair to lose it. The court notes importantly, at least the courts for nay, that in fact an appraisal had been done, a qualified appraisal done by the person who basically was signing off, and he used that appraisal to justify the contribution amount in question. So that appraisal had taken place, it was there, the only issue was getting it signed off upon, and in that case we were fine. This court says that they don't believe the nay case is the same thing. They note that the obtaining of a qualified appraisal is mandatory and not discretionary, and this provision was added by the Deficit Reduction Act of 1984, specifically to discourage the claiming of excessive amounts, that is, list a large amount on the tax return. Then, when you're finally examined at that point, go ahead, go out, try and find an appraiser and maybe back off, but you could play the audit lottery. The court notes that, in fact, the point of this was to force you to put your cards on the table up front. In this case, the failure we had was far more serious than the failure that had been noted in the bond case, because the bond case, we did have a real appraisal and the taxpayers had to live with it. Rather, in this case, the taxpayers got to go get their appraisal after litigation had already commenced. In this case, therefore, the court held these failures were far more serious than the failures in bond and rather much closer to the facts in the Hewitt case and DeArcangelo, which was a TC Memo 1994-572 case, where a similar set of problems occurred about documenting a charitable contribution. Now, the court did note the taxpayers had one last chance to basically save their deduction, or at least potentially did. The court notes that Regulation 1.170A-13C4IVH, how's that for a nice long reference, provided for an out that if an appraisal summary is not attached to the return, and if the taxpayer provides the information to the IRS within 90 days of a request from the IRS, the deduction will not be disallowed so long as the failure to attach the summary was a good faith error and a qualified appraisal was completed within the specified time period. In this case, we have a couple of problems. First, remember, the only thing that the taxpayer submitted during their time period was a letter that told us that we couldn't get an appraiser, the appraiser wouldn't sign off on the return, and a signed document from the DONI organization. Now, the regulations do provide for some relief if you can't get the DONI organization to sign, that is not fatal if you can establish reasonable cause for that happening. But the lack of the appraisal is fatal, as noted by the court. And in this case, the 90-day period had long since run before the taxpayers finally came forward with something approximating the appraisal they would need to sustain this deduction. And even in that case, to be honest, the appraisal clearly was not done in a timely fashion as required by the law. So the taxpayers had blown the out of potentially getting the 90-day period extended and getting a chance to use that time period to handle a potential correction to their failure to properly document their contribution on the original return. Now, what does this case teach us? Well, it teaches us a few things. If you hadn't learned your lesson in the Hewitt case, that it's very, very important to dot the I's and cross the T's, this case in Nay makes it clear again. If you have taxpayers that make large non-cash contributions, the appraisals must be completed. Taxpayers often balk at getting the appraisal because it's costly. Well, their choice is get the appraisal or give up the deduction. Secondly, this is one of those things that you as a preparer really don't want to miss on the taxpayer. If you're preparing a return for a taxpayer who's making such a charitable contribution, it's important for you to make sure the taxpayer understands they have to get that appraisal in place. If you're on the planning side, it's important that you explain to a taxpayer who's considering making such a contribution that they're going to have to line up an appraiser to get this signed off, and they're going to need to make sure their tax return is signed by the DONI organization. That would likely be true if you are the attorney planning this transaction, and you're not going to be the person preparing the tax return, you probably still have to notify the taxpayer that this is one case where the preparer could foul you up totally with no easy way of recovery. So make sure that they understand what needs to happen and what needs to go in with the return. As well, it's important for taxpayers to understand, your clients to understand, and you to explain to them that appraisals are normally restricted use documents. The mere fact that an appraisal may have been prepared for another purpose in the transaction, in this case, the negotiations for what became the eventual bargain sales price, does not mean that appraisal can be reused easily as the charitable contribution appraisal, or there's no big problem, we know the value. Appraisers regularly restrict the use of their reports, and they're not going to sign off and accept the responsibilities under the Internal Revenue Code for having an appraisal that was used for a charitable contribution, simply because the taxpayer says, well, you don't have to do any more work, I just need a signature. Actually, they do need to do more work, or at least they have significantly more exposure, so it's more than just the signature. CPAs especially should be able to explain this issue. If you take a look in the attest arena, you will notice that many CPA reports now are being issued for restricted use. That is, the audit report, the compilation, or the review report now can officially, under the standards, it's openly allowed for the report to be restricted to specific parties. And in fact, many advisors who advise CPAs on liability issues emphasize doing that, so at least you know who's supposed to be getting this report and who potentially is relying upon the report. So it doesn't become the whole world has a chance to come after you on that report. Well, appraisers have the same feeling. They're not going to just give up their signature for nothing. So taxpayers need to understand the need to get that signature and potentially pay an additional fee to have that signature placed on the return. CPAs certainly should understand this given the controversies that many of us have talked about and the concern many of us have expressed about some of the really odd requests we have received to sign letters claiming all kinds of things for taxpayers and clients who are trying to obtain a home mortgage. In the past couple of years, especially as the real estate market heated up here in Arizona, we got all kinds of interesting and oddball requests for a letter, usually pre-drafted, that the mortgage company wanted us to sign, and we kept balking at signing those letters because we were covered by the professional standards. An appraiser feels the same obligation, that there's a risk here to going forward with this, and unless they are compensated for taking on that risk, they're not going to do so. So your client has to understand the importance of explicitly contracting with the appraiser to obtain the appraisal for income tax purposes, and that the appraiser will agree to do the appraisal in the proper form and structure as required for the qualified appraisal rules under Section 170. If a taxpayer does not have that happen, they may find and have a nasty surprise when they go to file their return. Now, this has been the tax update for the week of September 23rd, 2006. As noted, I'll be in Roanoke and Memphis this week, and then coming back to Phoenix to head our way through the end of the individual tax filing season on October 15th. Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to visit them to take a look at the offerings they have for you to keep you updated on tax developments. This has been the Tax Update.